Hello, and welcome to the sixth edition of the Stuff We Like podcast. I'm David Simmons, and for the next half hour or so, we will be talking about stuff we like. And in this sixth episode, we will once again be looking at technology. Because technology surrounds us at all times, it can be very easy to get used to it and forget that once we used to live happily without it. For an example, look at the internet. Back in 1996, I surfed the web for the first time in a seminar in Finsbury Circus. Coming across such delights as Berkeley Square, which was a series of online shops which were designed to resemble a shopping arcade. And I remember the intrigue of CompuServe email addresses, which were all numeric back then, and the sheer excitement when emails had alphabetic names for a change. I remember ordering a bunch of flowers from an online shop and feeling quite decadent that such a thing could be achieved. One of the purposes of the technology episodes of Stuff We Like will be to flag up new technology, which may one day become a staple of our everyday lives. Or not. Who can tell what the public reaction will be? The Amstrad Mailer could have caught on globally, but didn't. Do you remember virtual reality suits such as were celebrated in the film The Lawnmower Man? You wore all sorts of complicated clothing in order to submerge yourself in an experience which was disconcerting, to put it mildly. The Segway is yet to catch on, although you can still rent them in various city centres. And closer to home, how about the netbook revolution? It caught on, only really to be trumped by tablets. And all the people who said, meh, the iPad will never catch on, they've had to eat their words, as the iPad just sells and sells and sells. And Google equivalents also sell and sell. And talking about Google, you've got to hand it to them. They innovate on an almost daily basis. And for every success, they have quite a number of flops, but you've got to hand it to them. They keep going, they keep trying, they keep on innovating. Who knows where Google Glass will be in 2015? The technology website Pocket Lint keeps on top of such developments, as do other publications, such as Wired or io9. And a few weeks ago, Pocket Lint showed a video of another innovative technological product. When I worked at the London Borough of Camden back in the 90s, many of my technological colleagues laughed when I said that one day they will create electronic paper. A company called Plastic Logic has created fully flexible high-resolution displays with an inbuilt processor called paper tabs. Don't be misled by the name, though. These aren't paper, but behave like magazine pages and display content in HD format and are aware when you put them next to each other, so that you can put three pages side by side to display a long picture running between each, for example. Bumping one page to another will transfer the content between them. And if you have a photo on one page, tap that page with another and it will attach the photo to the email that you're writing on the other page. It has to be seen to be understood. And the technology is still a little clunky, but it illustrates the power of technology to innovate endlessly and sometimes catch on in a way which makes our lives more, well, interesting. Just search Google for paper tabs and check out the video there. When I moved from being a Windows user to being a Mac user a couple of years ago, I was concerned I might not make the transition so easily. After all, I had been using Windows for almost 20 years, and to make matters even more complicated, because I'm now studying for a PhD, I need a piece of software called QSR NVivo, which at the moment only runs on Windows. So what should I do? A friend told me about a software product called Parallels for Mac. I bought a license and have never looked back since. What Parallels allows you to do is run a copy of Windows on your Mac in its own happy little environment, and the Mac OS carries on running, so you can run all of your Windows programs and all of your Mac programs all at the same time. The latest version of Parallels also lets you enter what they call coherence mode, so that basically you can run Windows programs without needing to go into Windows itself. They just run like ordinary Mac programs. Because the Mac OS is so memory efficient, you can run multiple programs all at the same time, and you notice very little performance dip. And there's good news for students and NVivo users, as they're also working on a Mac version of their software too. A few days ago, I was able to catch up with Dr. Andrew Tizard, who is a reader and lecturer at the University of Middlesex. and his specialty is in electrical impedance tomography. So if you want to know a little bit more about what that is and how it helps the medical profession in their quest for improving services in the NHS, have a listen. Dr. Andrew Tizard.
Oh, yes.
So tell us a bit about yourself, a bit about your background.
It goes back a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Because my field is engineering, and my origins, I suppose, undergraduate degree was mechanical engineering.
Right.
And I did, in the final year, I did some biomedical engineering, which was a great interest to me. But at the time, you didn't really get many people going into the field.
Okay.
It wasn't as popular as it is now.
So biomedical engineering, what does that deal with?
Oh, it's well, you know, you see a lot of medical equipment in hospitals.
Yep.
From your simple sphygmomanometer to measure blood pressure to very complicated machinery like MRI or CT scanners.
Yep.
You wouldn't find very many medics or clinicians having the skills to be able to design those.
Right.
But you need somebody who does. And
that's where you come in.
That's the biomedical engineers.
Okay.
But of course, in hospital now, biomedical engineers are also there to look after the equipment, maintain it, make sure it's functioning, and
okay,
and so on. So there's a whole range to the career
mm-hmm.
that a biomedical engineer could have. They could be in hospital, or they could be in industry. So you've got big people, big companies like Siemens and Philips.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of the very large companies. They make things from the very small equipment that's just by the bedside to MRI scanners, which is absolutely phenomenal.
Huge beasts, aren't they? Yeah.
It is one enormous, huge electromagnet.
Right, that's literally what it is.
It is, and the reason why they cool everything down is to try and improve the electrical properties of the coils so they conduct better and therefore generate greater magnetic fields.
And therefore improve the imaging.
Yes, it does improve the image contrast.
Sure. So your own research, because you're currently at Middlesex University, yes. And you've been there since time immemorial, but you've been doing quite a lot of research that's sort of cutting edge and stuff. Do you want to tell us as much of that as you can?
Well, yes, on the biomedical side, I guess I started that 12, 13 years ago when I was involved, or I was asked to be involved, in a research group where we needed to actually have accurate computer-aided design models or computer models of the human head.
Right.
Because we were working with a new emerging imaging technique, still isn't in the clinical environment, called electrical impedance tomography.
Right.
That images things by looking at the electrical properties of tissue. And the first thing I worked on was a research group we were looking at trying to image in real time an epileptic seizure.
Right.
And what happens in the brain when an epileptic seizure happens is that when you've got brain activity, you've got a lot of blood flowing there to give energy to the brain tissue that needs to function. But also you get the cells all swell up, and so that actually changes the electrical properties.
Right.
And with this technique, you can actually see that change.
Ah, so you're mapping what happens during an epileptic seizure.
Yeah.
Right.
We actually did publish some images of an epileptic seizure actually happening. Couldn't repeat it very easily.
No.
It was a kind of one-off, but it was still quite an important breakthrough. And that work is ongoing, but we've kind of withdrawn away from that now. And we moved on to looking at using the same
technology,
principles
and
the same technology to look at lungs.
Mm.
And lung function.
Okay.
And particularly we're interested in premature babies.
Oh, right.
Because they, when a child is born prematurely, and we're talking very prematurely here, the lungs are not fully matured, not fully mm-hmm. developed. And so generally a very premature baby is put on some kind of ventilator.
Mm.
And the lungs still need to carry on
functioning.
Carry on growing.
Right, yes, indeed. Yeah.
But how do you actually monitor the fact that they are growing? And also, how can you monitor the fact that you're providing the right kind of mechanical ventilation?
Because
they put on a ventilator.
Because,
you know, if you mechanically ventilate too much, you could cause permanent damage to the lungs. And
right.
If you don't do it enough, you're not getting enough oxygen.
And you have to stimulate them just enough so that they can grow at the natural rate.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
And so this technique can actually provide an opportunity to monitor that 24 hours a day, constantly.
Wow.
And allow the clinicians to actually have some greater level of control about how they do this. And of course, they have applications in adult intensive care too.
Of course.
And it's probably the most promising application of this technology. And there is even actually a clinical system, experimental, but a clinical system that was made available, and they had them in different places dotted around the country. Ormond Street had one, only at an experimental level, as I say, but we did work with them for a while to see if we can actually improve that system. That is ongoing, that is something we want to do, and provided we can get some more funding, we shall carry on doing that.
Right.
And that's kind of a vision of mine,
just
to see this stuff actually applied
in a real hospital environment. So in terms of technology that you've sort of grown up with in the last 30 years, the flat screen particularly intrigues you because it was something that you could see the potential of many, many years ago, long before it actually took place. Tell us about that.
I was kind of working with a university, but I was actually based in a company. And I was based in a well-known consumer electronics company.
Mm-hmm.
This company made, amongst other things, of course, televisions.
Yeah.
And what year am I talking?
1984, right.
So nearly 30 years ago.
Yes, we're getting 29 years ago.
Yeah,
yes.
That sounds absolutely dreadful just to even think about it, but 29 years ago, televisions were cathode ray tubes.
Yeah, huge things.
Huge things in wooden boxes, not even in plastic boxes.
Yeah, yeah.
The actual case of the television was laminated chipboard with a plastic cover on the back and this tube and a plastic mask around the outside of the tube to try and make it look reasonable with push buttons on it. And even a remote control was quite a luxury.
Yeah.
In those days, and I was working with the company in what it was like a technological think tank that the company had. So the idea was to come up with ideas, but one thing we were working on was the automation of assembling the televisions. Can we actually automate the process? But the other thing we did was to sort of have these ideation or brainstorming sessions to have a look at the future of television, and we sat for a couple of hours just throwing in bizarre ideas. And I remember, I think it was me, that said, yes, well, it would really be good if we had a television which was flat that you could hang on the wall.
Right.
And of course, being that kind of session, these bizarre, strange ideas were never thrown out. You kept them and you looked at them. And I can't remember really how we viewed that. We knew it was, at that time, impossible. And I think even our thinking at the time was that it would probably never be possible with technology that was around at the time. But nevertheless, the thought hung there and you thought, what if we could find a technology where we were able to actually reproduce television images, PAL images, on some kind of flat media?
As in 1984.
As in 1984.
Ironically, that's when you had the meeting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
telescreens.
And, you know, some years later, here we are.
Hmm. It is incredible, isn't it? The march of technology. And when you think now that an iPhone has as much computing power, so much more computing power than a mainframe did in 1990, the sheer volume of storage, let alone the actual power of the thing. And the iPad, of course, it's all flat. Everything is flat now.
Yes. Well, yes, at the march of technology, I think when I was a teenager and dabbled in computers, with a friend of mine, we went to his father's company and we played with a mini computer, which was a box about the size of two large microwaves next to each other.
Right.
Which had 4 kilobytes of memory.
Hmm.
Not megabytes.
Yes, kilobytes, that's right.
And that was an astonishing
amount of memory.
Well, it was an astonishing piece of technology. As I've grown up with the computing field, I've looked at more and more things that we're trying to do. And of course, I've done computer-aided things.
Mm.
I've used computers as tools in the engineering process. That's always been my specialism. That's the whole electrical impedance tomography thing. Is drawing on that skill set.
Right.
And each time that I enter into a new kind of project, I know that my demands for memory is more and more.
Mm.
So I'm thinking that there should be no end.
Yes.
to the increase of amount of memory that's available, because it's going to be needed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because each time we make a breakthrough and make an application of computing as a tool to help us solve a problem, we can see the potential for it to solve bigger and bigger problems.
Yeah, yeah.
If only we had. And it's always that if only.
We had the extra memory, the extra capacity.
Yes, the extra processing power.
Yeah, well, we could talk for hours, but thank you very much, Dr. T, for your time this evening, and doubtless we'll come back to you at another point.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you to Dr. Tizard from Middlesex University there. And if you ever want to keep updated with the world of technology, just download the Guardian Tech Weekly podcast. It's again totally free, but you get the best technology news and reviews, and they've frequently featured products which I have adopted and which have completely changed the way I've worked. An example being their episode in August 2009, which featured the simple revolutionary academic reference software called Mendeley. I shall talk more about that in episode 10, when we revisit technology. In listeners' comments, when we've asked about people's technological preferences, we've had an enjoyable range of replies, from the teaspoon to good old-fashioned conversation. Anthony McKernan would like to give a big shout-out to the Windows software application MW Snap. Once you download it for free, it enables you to take snapshots of your screen, add comments, arrows, and all sorts of things to it. Very useful for certain types of presentations. Anthony also mentions Evernote, as we mentioned in the last Stuff We Like. He features it as his Tuesday tool of the day. He says it's perfect for note-taking, documents, pictures, PDFs and all sorts. I'm always writing notes in different places, he says. At home, work on the train, but they all sync in the cloud and are waiting for me whether viewing on my phone, iPad or PC. He also pays tribute to the rechargeable battery, which certainly has transformed a lot of products. Andy Bradshaw mentions the Kinetic Watch, which uses a rotor in the same way that an automatic does, but uses the motion to charge a lithium battery. This means that in theory you won't need to open the back of the watch for at least 10 years. James Ratnaraja recommends the Day One app, which he calls a fantastic journaling app for iPhone and iPad. He also recommends iWriter, for a no-nonsense word processing experience. Tom Ronan wants to pay tribute to the Vox Lil Cooper, which is a great little electric guitar effects unit. It has a few basic effects, such as chorus, delay, overdrive, but best of all, has a 90-second looper, which allows you to record and then play back over a guitar riff. As it has two loopers, you can add further layers on top. It's great for endless noodling, even for the most cack-handed of guitarists. And the final Word on technology goes to Chris McLeod, who says the best bit of kit you can have is your brain, the best wetware you can get. One brain cell is more powerful than the best PC, it is an infinite hard drive, and should be one of your best and most treasured possessions. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Stuff We Like. But don't go before you follow me on Twitter. My name there is @DavidSimmons. We've also got a Pinterest board. You can get the address from that from me from Twitter. And that will take you to the Pinterest Stuff We Like board, where you can see all the stuff we've talked about over the last few episodes. You can also email me, dhsimmons@outlook.com. And you can download every previous episode of Stuff We Like just by subscribing to it through iTunes. It's totally free. Just look for David Simmons or Stuff We Like. Or you can also subscribe on Audioboo. Just look for my name and Stuff We Like again.